Welcome to the Sourdoughs Speak, the University of Alaska Broadcasting Services, in cooperation with Alaska Communication Arts, brings you this series of discussions about the history and development of the Great Valleys of Interior Alaska, the Yukon, and the Tanana, and the city of Fairbanks, which developed with the coming of miners during the Great Gold Stampedes at the turn of the century. In this series, the Sourdoughs Speak, pioneer Alaskans tell you their stories about their lives as they saw and played a part in the unfolding story of Alaskan growth. Now here is your host for this series, Neville Jacobs.
Man has developed ingenious methods of travel to help him get off his own 2 feet and onto something faster. And without the help of machines, this has usually meant harnessing some kind of animal. In the Arctic, from one end to the other, man harnessed the dog to help him achieve swifter travel. On open tundra, he hitched the dogs to long traces separately in a fan hitch, so they could spread out over the wide sweep of space. In the forest regions, he has hitched the dogs singly or in pairs, one in front of another, tandem, and this is the way they're hitched for racing in interior Alaska. But however they are hitched, before the automobile or airplane or snow machine, it was dog power that carried man over the miles across the snow and ice. In the North Country, dog teams and dog sleds are still important in some rural communities, although many families are beginning to rely upon snow machines for winter land transportation. In Fairbanks, dog mushing has become important as a winter sport. Fairbanks is home to the Alaska Dog Mushers Association, in fact, and the guest of this broadcast is one upon whom the Mushers Association bestowed the title Mr. Dog Musher nearly 20 years ago, in appreciation for his dedication to making sled dog mushing a living sport. Jeff Studdert served as president of the Alaska Dog Mushers Association for 2 years and has been a member of the board of directors for many more years. Studdert came to Alaska from Ireland in 1928 when his family had a business interest in a dredge on Fish Creek, beyond Cleary. We asked Jeff how he first got into dog mushing.
I started in when I was at Fish Creek, chiefly because there was a road of sorts to Cleary Summit, which had a roadhouse on it at the time. It was from there down to Fish Creek. It was unbroken snow in the spring, and the crew went in on snowshoes, and I hauled the grub in with the dog team.
How many dogs did you have?
Well, I had about 7 to start with. And since that time, I've had varying numbers.
Well, you kept the dogs then?
I have always, since that time, kept dogs, yes.
And what kind of dogs were these?
Originally, they were anything I could scrounge up, and I used them as a freight team, which is quite different to what I usually most of them for now, because it's a long time since we've had any freighting, at least in the Fairbanks area. But for quite a few years, to go to the logging camps and various places out of Fairbanks, you went with a dog team or else. That was the only way to go. In those days, there were dog trails in all directions. And the mail was hauled from here to Circle, or at least from Chattanooga to Circle. Sometimes the road was navigable to Chattanooga for trucks, not always. And, of course, the mail all down the Yukon from Nenana was with a dog team, hauled it all the way down to St. Michael's.
Well, what's the difference between a freighting dog and, or say, some other kind of a dog?
A racing dog?
A racing dog, mm-hmm.
Well, it's just like the difference between a racehorse and a cart horse. I mean, your freight dogs are much heavier, much slower, and much fatter as a rule. A racing dog has as little fat on him as possible because he can't run if he's packing a lot of excess weight.
Well, now, would these dogs necessarily be Eskimo dogs or Huskies?
No. A dog could be any kind of a dog. It's the same way even in the racing dogs. You see the most extraordinary difference. You'll see maybe 3 or 4 different, quite different looking kinds of dogs in a race team even now. And the dog with a pedigree and all that kind of stuff as a general rule, does not make a good race dog. They look prettier, but they haven't got what it takes. The honest-to-God old Malamute, as we call him there, he would never quit. If he did, you give him a half an hour and he'd get back and get back on the ball. That's why with a dog team, you practically always got home with the dogs, and you take a snow go, and lots of times you walk home, you better have snowshoes. I did a little freighting around here and used to haul my own wood in and all that kind of thing, and go out to the logging camps. The people who were logging would go out in the fall, and not that they would be so far away, but they didn't have any means of getting into town, so you'd bring them out supplies. And in those days, you never went without the newspapers. See, there were no radio in those days, and if you showed up in a camp without most of the last month's newspapers, they wouldn't talk to you even.
Because
that was the only way they had of keeping up.
There were no instant communications?
No, absolutely not. It was totally different. And the tractors were just coming in when I first came. It was still for many years they logged with horses here. And a great deal of most of the wood that this town burnt just wood and coal. Of course, there was no oil in those days, and most of the wood came in with horses. There was very little to do up here in the wintertime in those days, very little to do.
So you got into the, you were known as Mr. Dog Musher himself?
Yes, I got some various names, just because I've been at it so long, and I have done quite a little bit for the Mushers. I saw my first dog team in 1928. A man by the name of Joe Stickman, now dead.
Yes.
He was the man that won the Chattanooga race in 28. That was the first dog team I ever saw. But I have seen all the major dog races since the year 28. I've never missed one.
In 1928, when you first came here that winter, what were the races like at Chattanooga or the Fairbanks area?
Well, there were two races in those days. There was the race to Chattanooga, which was a 60-mile race, one day. And then there was the Endicott Trophy, which I believe was a 16-mile race. And that was the only races that you...
Now, that was held here in Fairbanks, the 16-mile race?
Yeah. They were both in Fairbanks, and then there was the ladies' race. They called it the Frome Trophy. And that was, just as I say, there were just those three, two for the men and one for the ladies then. The longest one was the one to Leidengood and back. It was 80 miles over and 80 miles back. And that was quite a race, I can tell you. It was only run twice. It was 165 miles. In 1940, that was done in 18 hours. And in 1941, it took them 20 hours. Yeah, condition of the trail was not too good. That was a rough race because somebody went over to Livengood ahead of you with a dog team, and that was the trail. It was just the one dog trail. I mean, there was nothing like there are now. If you caught a man and passed him, it was you were wading off in the deep snow, and it was quite different. They were quite different type of dog. 80 miles isn't going to be the same type of dog that you're going to run 20 miles. You know what I mean? They run much slower. The whole setup was different. The sleds were heavier. The harnesses were heavier. Now, all nine dog harness now for nine dogs wouldn't weigh much more than what one harness used to weigh in the old days. They had regular miniature collars on them, like a small horse collar and everything, when I first saw them. And the dogs now go off in high gear. I mean, they're in 10 feet, they're going full blast. In the old days, they used to start off in a trot. Stickman and Nolner came up from New Lato, They marched all the way in from New Ladder to run the races here, 400 miles. That's over 400 miles to get here. Mm-hmm. And so that is, you can see they have quite a different type of dog there.
No highways except the wide rivers, no airlines. It is hard to imagine the problems of transportation in Alaska during the winter. And to enter a dog race in Fairbanks, men mushed 400 miles up the Yukon. There were trails and roadhouses, but we wondered how many people actually set out on these overland trails during a winter.
There were a lot of people on this all the time. I mean, there never a day passed that there wouldn't be somebody going, unless there was, the cold was so bitter they couldn't make it. There would be somebody going and coming all the time. I mean, you had these definite roadhouses, and there was, of course, quite a little bit of horse traffic later on, you know. You had double enders and cutters coming out of Valdez. They used to, a lot of, I have talked to Mr. Ferguson. He used to be with the Independent when I went to work up there, and he tells me about coming over, told me about coming over Thompson's Pass. They would have a whole string of horses and a double ender.
I hate to ask you.
I don't know if you have any idea what a double ender is.
No,
it's a sled that's about 3.5 feet wide, about 8 feet long, and it's turned up on both ends so you can back it up or go ahead and go in either direction. Oh. Well, they would come up over Thompson's Pass with, say, 40 or 50 horses and sleds. Well, they drive about 20 loose horses ahead. They would break down the trail, and when the lead horse got too tired, they'd give it a shove off on the snowbank. And then the next one would take up, and when it got, and so then they'd fall in at the end, rotating them. They used to, in certain places, I think it was Valley's Creek, somewhere up there, they used to haul their logs with the dogs too. We used to have regular, I've seen them, I've used them here to haul firewood, regular little double-enders sleds that you'd use with a dog team. Probably 2 feet wide and regular bob sled, and about 8 feet long, and you'd load it just like you would a horse sled, like they did with the wood.
And how many dogs would usually be?
Probably about nine.
Nine dogs.
The teams, the race teams now are way, way bigger than they used to be in the old days. A 10-dog race team was a large team first. And now you see them up, the biggest team was 16 this year in the North American, and a lot of 14s. The mail carriers would use 20 dogs usually, and lots of times two sleds hooked one behind the other. And the man, and very often there was only one man, and he would ride either skis or a Ouija board. A Ouija board is like a little double-ended flat sled. It's probably 14 inches wide, about 30 inches long, and a little bit of turn up in front and the back. And it's hooked onto the tow line on the sled, so you can stand on it, and you have what they call a jeep pole, which is an arm off the front of your sled with which you can steer it, because you can't steer a loaded sled from the back, but you can steer it quite easily from the front. And they call it a jeep because it's on the right. This pole is on the right, and you can stand on that and keep your sled in the track, quite simply. Skis are better. You have a ski on each side, and it's attach the tow line, and if you come to a bad hill, you can step out of this and get on the back and stand on your brake so the sleds don't run over the dogs or anything like that. But that was the way the mail carriers handled their teams.
We asked if it were difficult to build a dog sled.
Sled making is an art. Really, very few people are able to make a sled that is really a good sled. That's according to my idea that anyhow, there are more nowadays, there are more people making them, but it's quite an art. A sled has to be very flexible so that if one runner is up in the air, The other runner can be down. They ride over the bumps and humps. In fact, the things often feel like they're falling apart.
Yes.
But that way they run easier.
And they're lashed together.
They're with rawhide,
yes,
known as babiche. In a sled, maybe there'll be six bolts is probably all that you'll find in the sled. All the rest is rawhide. It's a very great art, and not too many people really can make what I call a first-class sled. It's really something that just the average person, you might be a first-class carpenter, and you make a lousy sled because it'd be too stiff. People that make the best sleds are people that have used sleds, and they understand what they need. You can go, if you've got a nice light sled, you can, and it's flexible. It takes one or two less dogs to do the same amount of work. I have a little story of a mail carrier down the Yukon that always amuses me. The man's name was Fred Clark, and he was down this post office one night, and he unloaded the mail. He left it in there for the night, and his old Indian came up, and he said, "Fred, me follow you tomorrow, okay?" Fred said, "Joe, that'd be just fine, like a little company." So Fred loaded up in the morning. He had nine dogs and his load of mail, and he took off, and old Joe shows up, and he has one dog, one little sled. And the first mile, old Joe runs along behind, and he gets in the sled and rides a mile, and he runs a mile. Fred made 25 miles at noon, and Joe's still there. So they stopped and had lunch, and they made another 10 miles. That was Fred's usual stopping place. But he just wanted to see how long Joe and the one dog could go. So he made another 10 miles. That was 45 miles. And they got into his place that night, and Fred said to Joe, "Joe, how far would you have gone if I hadn't been ahead of you today?" He said, "Maybe 10 miles more." You know, and Fred said, "I never asked a question like that again." Fred was just a-going hard. He was real tired when he got in after, nine dogs and his load of mail. Well, old Joe had the one sled there, and he was just tooting along right behind him. It's surprising none of the mushers nowadays here have made any real long runs. I have never made 60 miles, the most I have ever made, and that isn't considered too long a run. A lot of these fellows would make that quite often, and in... they were a lot much colder than I have. I tell you, I've mushed at 52 below, and that was awfully cold with the wind blowing down the Yukon.
When did it become a sport for you? You said that you had always had dogs.
Yeah, I don't exactly know. One hardly ever keeps track of these things in time. Really, just as soon as I got some dogs that were a little bit better and could run, and I was always interested in it, I got in there, and as I say, they wouldn't let me go anywhere but last. I had such a mean bunch of dogs. Anything I could pick up, I had some of the world's meanest and worst, nastiest dogs. They did what I needed. And that was all you wanted, all you could ask for. But it's always been a hobby with me.
What makes some dogs, do you suppose, meaner than some dogs mean? And some
it's
dogs
the same as the human beings. Well, you ask why some people you can't stand, they want to bite you all the time. It's the same way. The average dog, though, is comparatively good-natured nowadays. I mean, we herd them into the truck there. I carry 20 dogs in a pickup there lots of times, and we very seldom have trouble. In fact, if nowadays, where there are more dogs to be found, I think most people get rid of the fighters. They are too expensive to keep, because a dog you want to get rid of never gets hurt, never. It's your best lead dog is the one that something like that always seems to get mixed up in the fight.
This brings up the question of lead dogs. How do you train a lead dog?
Well, that is a question, too, that's hard telling. You start off with your team in the ordinary course events, and you put in your pups, and you run them a little bit, and you gradually bring them further up in the team, nearer the head, according as they get more exercise, can run faster, and the good ones you start putting up in front. The lazy ones you put in the wheel.
I see.
Where you can remind them of it once in a while.
Yes.
But the good ones you put up in front, and then for some reason or other you are a shorter lead dog. That's what usually happens, and you take one of these other ones that you've had in the swing or behind there, and you put it up and see what it does. And if it acts well, then you run it there a little bit more, and you probably make a lead dog out of it. Because if it, some of them just don't like to be out in front. I've had it at times, one of the best lead dogs I ever owned. It was a hot day in spring, and I'd never had this dog out of the wheel before. But she was the only one out of 11 dogs that wanted to work, so I put her up in front, and I never took her out of it. I never took her out again. I always had her in front for the rest of her life. She just naturally wanted to run out ahead, and she was an excellent Gian Haw dog.
Now, what do you mean by that?
You take commands. That's now, just the only way you can turn a dog is say G or Haw.
I see.
Or come back Haw, which means turn the whole team around and come back. Turn it right around and come back down the trail you're going on.
What happens if your sled turns over and you're tossed and the dogs get up and go on? What do you...
you use some, some bad language and they yell at them and figure out what's the nearest way home. The average dog will not... I had a dog called Star that I call my kennels after, that would bring the team back to me, but on the average... they are excited and run on till they tangle. And the sled catches and something, or for some reason or other, they get all messed up. Then they'll stop and maybe have a fight, maybe sit down and wait for you. You try never to do that, because the dogs may run you. They may run 20 miles. You can't tell where they're going to run. If you have, for instance, if you lost them in the first mile of the 20 mile in the race course here, they might go around the course, or they might turn off anywhere, and you have no idea where you're going, where they're going to land.
Box.
Yeah, and there's the other worst possibility is the fact that one dog will get tangled, and will get killed or hurt or break his leg or something like that. We had that happen there in the ladies' race here this year. Mrs. Norris's team ran 5 miles, but it didn't get tangled. The sled was on its side, and one dog had a half hitch around his leg, but otherwise they were uninjured. It can happen, but the thing, if you do get upset and knocked off, as I know from being crippled, I didn't dare. I only once lost them when I was crippled. I got an unexpected, I wasn't hanging on, but ordinarily you hang on like grim death there, and they may drag you quite a ways, but your sled is usually not upright. If it's upright, it's not so easy to stop, but if it's on the side, you can usually run it into a snowbank long enough to slow it down and get yourself back up on the sled. But it's something that you could never explain to anybody what it feels like to be on the back of a fast dog team. It just is. I've never been able to explain it to anybody, but there's just nothing like it. I used to love it, and of course I'm afraid to drive alone anymore now with the teams as fast as they are. I'm afraid of losing them, you know, and I'm not afraid of getting hurt. I'm just afraid of losing them and the dogs get away from me.
Right, now you're standing on the sled runners.
Yeah. On these little light sleds.
Yes.
And they go one from one side to the other. They run up a bank and then they shoot. It's something like bobsledding. It takes a very delicate sense of balance. And you've got to be thinking. A dog's going around a corner, a slick corner, at 25 miles an hour. He speeds up. A dog will speed up for a corner. He'll always go slower on the straight. And he always wants to see what's around the corner. If you get it in the spring when the... like it was last year, for instance, when there was no snow and the ground was hard.
Yes.
And your sled would just slide maybe 5 feet, just slick around the corner. and then it slides into a bank and will tend to throw you over on the outside. You get so you can raise it up on one runner. You bounce it on one runner, on the inside runner, and then it doesn't slide so much because it cuts. And if it does hit the bank, you are at a different angle. If you're young, you can hop off.
Yeah.
The young people, they hop off, but when you get old, like me, it was just strictly on the sense. Your sled really careers around the place. You have to help the dogs. I mean, the sled starts whacking around, throws your wheel dogs off and makes it hard on them, maybe knocks them over the line and jerks them and all that kind of thing, too. You know, gets slack in the line and then gives a jerk and all that kind of thing,
and
too.
In other words, you help them by the control of the sled.
Oh,
the
yes.
The way you handle the sled.
There's a lot to the handling of the sled as to how the dogs run. It's not something that you learn in a day. It's years of practice, and there's an old saying with us, anything can happen in a dog race, and usually does.
Jeff talks about one of the unusual events held during the annual North American Championship races.
I have my own race. Jeff started Invitational Race. Each year on the Wednesday before the North American, we have this year we shortened it on account of climatic condition and everything else to 8 miles, always being 10 miles. It was the 18th running of this particular race. And you have to get an invitation for me to race, and I make the rules. Yeah, they're all, except the amount of dogs you use, they're all normal rules. And I don't draw, I go first. Whether it's snowstorm or not. A bunch of us fellows that weren't doing much and decided one year that we'd have a little race amongst ourselves, and we each put in $5, winner take all. And this started back 18 years ago. This year, we had an 8-mile race. It's a passenger race. The person that's the passenger sits there. He doesn't move out. And we had... For every 100 pounds that you had 3 dogs. Now, that was slightly different. And if I'd had more chance to exercise and everything, sure, I'd have kept the weight. It used to be 30 pounds to the dog. And the last 3 years, it has been a passenger race, but each person went 5 miles. See, I would drive the first 5. A fellow with me would drive. You'd swap at the halfway mark. And... that's the way it was for about 3 years like that. After I decided that I was scared to take 10 dogs out alone on that. I was afraid of losing them. I didn't bother about getting hurt or anything. I've fallen off a sled too often. There's an art in that. There's no reason unless you run into a tree, but that'd be hard to do. But so I changed it over to this passenger race, and we've been having a lot of fun. We don't have as many entries because it takes more dogs for it.
Uh-huh.
Because we used to have about 20 entries for that.
How many did you have this year?
10.
I see. Let me ask you one more question. You said there's an art to falling off a sled.
There is.
How do you fall off a sled?
you can't tell what you learn. And I've taken lots of hard falls, but you just let yourself relax.
Sled dog mushing and racing is one of the world's most unique and challenging activities. We have barely glimpsed beneath the surface of this fascinating world in our talk with Jeff Studdard, but we hope we have gained some insight into the problems, difficulties, and special skills that are a part of the dog musher's life. In our next broadcast, we'll travel with another pioneer Alaskan, this time on foot with Sam White, who tells us about a trip from Fairbanks to Eagle, Circle City, and back. This is Neville Jacobs, inviting you to join us again for a visit with an Alaskan pioneer in our next broadcast of the Sourdough Speak.
You have been listening to The Sourdoughs Speak, a series of discussions about the history and development of interior Alaska in taped interviews with pioneer Alaskans. The Sourdoughs Speak was produced by Alaska Communication Arts in conjunction with the University of Alaska Broadcasting Services.